so feel important. You are light. You are principle. When you
This is Subliminal Radio Casting, and you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio.
Thank you.
So we are having a very special radio show today. We have some guests appearing, and we are all going to be reading our college essays, which is humiliating, but you know, it is what it is. And so I will be starting us out. My topic is squirrels. Squirrels cannot be trusted. They prance around, putting on a facade of innocence that most people buy into. At one time, even I fell for their tricks. Deep down, though, I can never dismiss all of their wrongdoings. The seed of resentment sprouted within me, and there it will stay. Too many acorns taken after countless hours of collecting. Cortland, Studewood, and 11th. These streets made up the world for Katie Brooks, age 2. Home base and the borders of my world all littered with rocks, leaves, pink buttercups, and acorns. The treasures I found were kept in a cardinal red bucket and never allowed inside the house. This, of course, resulted in disaster, as I could only watch from the door, pressed up against the glass, as my loot was taken, and the acorns I had toiled to collect were stolen. Katie Brooks, age 6, and all the rage was rocks. These were of less interest to the squirrels I've discovered. As I expanded my borders across Texas, obsidian, fool's gold, bivalves, and gastropods were all secretly stashed in the bottom of my mom's purse. She did not appreciate them as much as I did, so I used her purse less and wore pockets more. Katie Brooks, age 9, was all about fossils and desperate to learn how to make flower crowns. Prehistoric relics in my room, rust-colored leaves strewn throughout my hair, and leftover buttercups discarded in the grass. Turns out I do, in fact, like butter from the yellow tinge of pollen left on my chin. Katie Brooks, age 12, discovered books and was dragged to Big Bend National Park to explore along the Mexican border. Only tempted by the opportunity to see a bear and with thoughts of giant cats, I ventured out to the Lost Mine Trail. Crisp with early morning chill and whispers of magic as the dense fog settled below the peak, a blanket of silence created something sacred. Magic and Mikhail Buglikov wove together to promise that maybe mornings did have something to offer to a preteen. Katie Brooks, age 17, and still picking up treasures. Although my borders now stretch from Batu Caves, north of Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to Masaya Volcano near Granada, Nicaragua, the adventures of Katie, age 2, continue with everything I hide away in my mom's purse. The acorns I began with have grown, the roots reaching out to far, unfamiliar locations, pulling me along, promising new experiences and adventures. The streets I knew have lengthened, and new places have become just as important as my neighborhood. I've collected more than just acorns and rocks. I now have songs and books, tastes and feelings, but it's still not enough. I want to go further, start a new adventure. I'm ready to reframe my borders, change my intersections, find new squirrels to resent, live through a real winter. My world is so much bigger than Katie Brooks, age 2, ever imagined. and I want to keep it growing. I want to be able to look back to where I am now and realize that there was still so much I had yet to discover. My past experiences taught me lessons I can't forget, and I'm ready to learn more. Katie Brooks, age 2, knew 3 things for certain. My world ends at the busy intersections of Studemont and 11th. All that I collected has a measurable value. Squirrels can never be trusted.
Thank you. is Common App essay number 2 in our little series. I wear colorful clothing, smell sweet, and stay still. The trick is to impersonate a flower. My petals are yellow and orange tie-dye, my scent a fresh department store bloom, and my forearm a stretch of runway. I catch one, then two at a time, nudging specimens into confinement. They hurl themselves against the walls, fluttering to exhaustion. When I was younger, the glass cases filled with butterflies lining my grandpa's halls confused me. I couldn't figure out how the insects held position without twitching even once. No one explicitly told me they were dead, but somehow, over the years, I understood. How could anyone catch that many butterflies? How could anyone kill that many butterflies? Now I am the person who catches, who kills those butterflies. I do it so I can see. With their flapping permanently paused, I see the intricate patterns crafted in their wings. I can appreciate the creatures as pieces of art. After retrieving the captured swallowtail from the freezer, I hydrate the specimen to combat the brittleness of its now barren body. I layer damp towels in a sealable box, spiraled antennae, jagged legs, and origami wings become flexible again. The oxymoron is that my goal is to make the dead appear alive. To do so, I focus on both the simple and the complex. The simplicity of displaying a butterfly as it would appear naturally, caught on a carnation blossom moments before, and the complexity of preserving its fragile forewings and kaleidoscopic setae. When successfully pinned, the butterfly appears like something I would see passing in nature, part of the normal landscape. Yet when I examine the specimen, I see that it is anything but mundane. Through preservation, I can pause the fast forward of life and look in a way that I am not otherwise able to do, in stillness. I confine the specimen in the groove of the mounting board, trapping wings under strips of parchment paper, a prisoner in stocks. I secure its position with two pins, careful not to pierce the delicate chitin scales. Using metal forceps in place of oily fingers, I gently grasp the forewing, pulling upwards. But I am too tentative, and I lose grip of the wing, watching as it slips back down. Being able to see in stillness and hesitation gives me the opportunity to perceive in a new way. I see our similarities. The more I feel connected to the butterfly, the more I want to protect it. I hope that through preservation, I can elicit the same response in others. Within the process, I become methodical, but the swarm of butterflies I have caught and killed circles inside my mind. And I wonder, to what extent does building appreciation for many justify the death of one? Butterflies do not feel pain, their lifespans are short, and specimens are even bred for pinning, but does that make it ethical? I pin additional paper strips over the outer margins so each segment remains taut. Taut paper, taut wings, and a taut rope in the tug of war between reality and its imagination. Antennae are notoriously difficult to manipulate, yet I work with them until they curve up and slightly out, tips enveloping themselves to form the smallest of spirals. Finally, the process is complete. When I look at a butterfly, really look at it, I observe that its elegance is immortalized within a shadow box. This single butterfly captures all of the work and attention to detail I put into preserving it, the vast and complex role the butterfly plays in nature, and even more, the fragility of our natural world. In preservation, the swallowtail is renewed, perhaps by giving it new function, I have given it new life. Blow on it and watch it flutter away.
Thank you. This is essay number 3 in our series. Forewarning, this starts with a real life quote that was said to me. We got some trannies back in Texas, and sometimes they'll come to school in dresses or something, so my buddies and I will grab those F-slurs and shove them into lockers till they either sissy cry or man up. I'd been waiting for a moment like this for my entire life, one where I could look pure hatred in the eye and without hesitation fight for everything I am and everything for which I stand. But in this moment, there were no traces of my prior life. I wasn't the brave young man living as his authentic self, or the trailblazer working with the administration to make our school accepting. Here, I was Sam the man, the frat god, and just another 17-year-old guy at the Air Force Academy. So in that moment, I did what the frat god would do. Without hesitation, I looked Riley in the eye, laughed, and said, "Nice, bro." I come from a bubble, this enclosed society where word spreads like wildfire, scorching the earth indefinitely. From the minute I stepped out of that closet, I was no longer Sam. I'd forevermore be the transgender kid. As the first person to transition since 2006, when the community's rejection drove the last person to suicide, I was an opportunity for redemption. I was their prized possession, promised acceptance and protection on the implied condition that I be their poster child. I was thrust into the role of activist, one which I took on wholeheartedly. I became the president of the Gay Straight Alliance, got gender-neutral bathrooms installed district-wide, wrote the guidelines for trans athletes, mentored peers struggling with gender identity issues like my own. I was the voice of a movement. And yet, something felt wrong. If I paraded around advocating against hardships I'd never faced, was I not a fraud? Conditioned by the bubble to believe that activism must come from adversity, I knew the only way to vindicate my voice was to dive into hostile environments and brave discrimination. But for some reason, I still couldn't seem to find it. How was it that even when I begged for hatred to strike, it left me untouched? Here I was, disappointed when no one assaulted me in the public men's restroom, and frustrated when MIT's ROTC commander sat a foot away from my face asking about my dreams as a little boy. I had to up the ante, go stealth at Air Force Academy's summer seminar, sharing barracks with America's toughest alpha males and being held to the physical standards of a biological man, but with no safety net. "Yo, let's play shirts versus skins," some guy shouted on the football field that first day. I held my breath, narrowly escaping exposure as I was picked for shirts. 2,000 miles away from my label, I was a blank slate, until I scored the game-winning touchdown, earning me the new identity of frat god in everyone's respect, especially Riley's. I became so blinded by just being a normal guy that when the long-sought moment of adversity finally arrived, I used it to validate myself as a man rather than authenticate myself as an advocate. I returned home, guilt-ridden for having selfishly put my wants above the needs of this community. So I texted Riley and outed myself as one of those trannies he so proudly shoved into lockers. "Still think I'm the frat god?" I waited an empty threat until the screen finally illuminated, leaving me dumbfounded. "Hell yeah, man. I guess I never met one before, but you changed the way I see them." But this time, I did what Sam would do. I closed my phone, stared my reflection in the eye, smiled, and said, "Nice, bro." For in that moment, I was exactly what I thought I could never be, a genuine, impactful activist. There's more than one path to making a difference, and I'm on it.
Thank you. this is the fourth addition to our little Coming Up essay segment. As I crunched down upon the starter's request, I glanced up from the 200 meter bend and took a deep breath as someone shouted my name from the stands. I'd been in this position several times. At 15, I was already an accomplished national athlete and accustomed to the excitement and tension that accompanied each race. Today would be different though. 12 seconds into the race, I attempted to switch gears and rocket to the finish line. Suddenly, my face riled in pain as it kissed the cold track while my left hamstring throbbed in agony. That vibrant atmosphere I enjoyed moments ago seemed to suffocate me with every passing second. Soon, the medical personnel on site wrapped my leg in ice and I hobbled slowly to the bleachers, grimacing with every step. It felt like an eternity. It was not the injury that was so devastating. It was not the injury that was so devastating, as I had strained the same leg during a relay race in Barbados. It was the overwhelming feeling of being alone and invisible that truly disturbed me that day. On that long walk back to the stands, I noticed club supporters, athletes, and a few coaches. Yet, no one I encountered reached out to offer a kind word or a reassuring look. It was as though my current circumstance rendered me unfit for their attention, or perhaps they felt that they had nothing to say. I made my way to the back of the supporters' area and sat somberly, my left hamstring resting gingerly on an ice pack. My ears burned with the muffled cacophony of the lively rhythm section of the club's supporters cheering on the other athletes. I called home and left, taking a remote exit, not daring to risk being unnoticed a second time. I slowly clawed my way back to final start lists and eventually winner's row. That meant listening to my body, relying on my own judgment, and ignoring commentators who serve no useful purpose. Recovering from a devastating injury is as much a mental struggle as a physical one. I believe that during that mid-teen period, I experienced a mental growth spurt. During the months that was spent trying to reestablish my dominance in the field, the excitement and tension at the starting line took a slightly different tone. There was no lively banter directed at me from former rivals. I was largely ignored, invisible once again. This time, however, being invisible would become my superpower. Being forced to face that long trek to the bleachers alone, followed by the equally lonely road to physical recovery, has made me a mentally tough and grounded athlete. The experience of having to depend on myself to overcome this setback has sharpened my focus on pursuing my goals. I've also grown into a more compassionate person and have become more empathetic towards my teammates who seek my advice. I freely share my knowledge and experience, having learned a good deal from physiotherapists and kinesiologists. I encourage them to seek expert advice, follow their judgment, and ignore noise from the naysayers. My invisible moment, as I have come to call this pivotal moment in my life, has taught me to cherish the genuine relationships I have with my friends and classmates. Rather than simply giving them answers, I now earnestly help my classmates by patiently explaining complex math problems and solutions to those who need it, especially at exam time. I can recall an incident in Form 4 when I deliberately asked my math teacher to explain a problem, even though I understood it perfectly. I was ridiculed for asking her what seemed to be a dumb question, but I wanted to ensure that she gave a thorough explanation for the other boys, whom I knew were struggling to understand. In my own small ways, I seek out the invisible and do my best to bring out their light. End of essay. Thank you.
If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover the camera up with a piece of opaque tape? In addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware and viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you. So if you don't use it, consider covering it up. A message in the public interest from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Thank you all for listening in to this super special episode of Subliminal Radio Casting. You are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Thank you.